I'm Steve Skinner with Stacey Stein.
We are joined on the phone by Dr. David Katz. He is a preventative medicine specialist and globally recognized authority on lifestyle medicine. Dr. Katz is the founding director of Yale University's Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center, past president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, president and founder of the nonprofit True Health Initiative, and founder and CEO of Diet ID Incorporated. Dr. Katz is a fellow of the American College of Preventative Medicine, the American College of Physicians, the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, and Morris College, Yale University. He earned his BA at Dartmouth College, his MD at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and his master's in public health from the Yale University School of Public Health, and completed sequential residencies in internal medicine and preventative medicine and public health, earning board certification in both disciplines. Dr. Katz practiced clinical medicine for 25 years, first in primary care, internal medicine, subsequently in a model of evidence-based integrative medicine team care he developed, the recipient of numerous awards for teaching, writing, and contributions to public health. Dr. Katz was a 2019 nominee for a James Beard Foundation Award in Health Journalism and has received 3 honorary doctorates. He holds multiple U.S. patents, has over 200 peer-reviewed publications, has published many hundreds of online and newspaper columns, and has authored and co-authored 18 books to date, including multiple editions of leading textbooks in both nutrition and preventative medicine. Recognized by colleagues as the Poet Laureate of Health Promotion, Dr. Katz has given keynote addresses in all 50 United States and countries on 6 continents. He has appeared on most major media outlets and reaches a social media following of nearly 1 million. His 18th book, How to Eat, co-authored with food writer and New York Times columnist Mark Bittman, is available now. Dr. Katz, welcome to the show.
Wow, Stacey, that was the full Monty of an intro. Thanks very much.
Do you really do all that stuff? That's amazing, doctor.
No. I think my mother made it all up.
Dr. Katz, tell us what lifestyle medicine is and why we should care.
Well, it really is leveraging the most powerful influences on our health, promote longevity, vitality, prevent disease. And the components begin with diet, which is actually the single leading predictor variable for all-cause mortality in the United States today. Believe it or not, the number one thing that kills people prematurely in our country is poor diet quality. That's even true during the pandemic, but it was true before. It will be true after. Physical activity, our exposure to toxins like too much alcohol or tobacco, quality and quantity of our sleep, how we manage mental stress, the quality of our social interactions. Those are the core components. And you know, in each of those areas, there's opportunity for experts to provide guidance. You can learn about sleep hygiene. You can learn strategies to manage stress. You certainly can learn a lot about nutrition and get coaching for physical activity. If you get that formula right, the lifestyle medicine formula, you absolutely can add years to your life, add life to your years. You can do the same for everybody you love, because unlike any other kind of medicine, this is medicine you can and should pay forward to your loved ones. And in the midst of this pandemic, there's an immediacy to it all that I think completely changes the value proposition. You know, one of the problems for folks in my profession is we have a hard time selling it. You know, everybody, okay, I understand that if I ate right and exercised, that you know, I'd be less likely to get heart disease later or less likely to get diabetes. But, you know, I'm busy today. I've got other things to worry about. You know, I'll get to it tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, and tomorrow never comes. And that's a problem, because, you know, people get religion about health and about lifestyle as medicine only after a calamity, after they've had a heart attack or stroke, something that didn't need to happen. But right now, during this pandemic, everybody is acutely anxious about their risk of COVID. And it turns out that the things that you can do to reduce your risk of a severe infection are the very things that can add years to your life and life to your years in general. And so, you know, I think there's a great opportunity to take control of your personal risk in the midst of this pandemic, do something about it, and also improve your health for the long term. So that is the value proposition of lifestyle as medicine.
Dr. Katz, we are certainly have fertile ground in the United States for these improvements that you discussed, and we are up against those things like climate change. We know it's coming. We can see it's there. We don't do anything about it. And the same with our health. If we're smokers and we're young, we're like, hey, I like smoking now, and it's fine. And we're also faced with this onslaught of marketing. If you watch football, for example, you're going to see ads for Chick-fil-A, McDonald's, giant pickup trucks, never mentioning that this stuff is absolute poison to you. So we're marketed in the opposite direction, and the medical communities, it feels like it's really caught up to diet being a big part of our lives and even climate change and those kinds of things. How do you face the beast of modern marketing with truth?
Well, first of all, Steve, I agree completely with everything you just said, and I think it really is valuable to note the overlap between what we can do with diet and lifestyle for our own health and what we can do for the planet. One of the things we advocate in lifestyle medicine is for plant-predominant dietary patterns and for dietary patterns made up of real food, not pseudo-ultra-processed frankenfood. And if you move along both of those axes, from highly processed food to minimally processed food, from animal food, so meat, eggs, and dairy, to plant foods, in both cases, you're reducing the environmental footprint of your diet, and you're making that diet better for your health, and you're making it kinder and gentler to our fellow creatures. So you could look through the three lenses of human health, planetary health, and the ethical treatment of life on this planet. You know, it's the trifecta. You win all three. So I completely agree with you about what's at stake. And I also completely agree with you with the problem. Those places around the world where people derive the greatest benefit from diet and lifestyle, they don't do it by virtue of willpower. They do it by virtue of culture, a culture that makes eating well normal, that makes physical activity normal. In particular, I'm thinking of the world's five blue zones where people routinely live to be 100. And so they don't have to overcome a culture that runs on Dunkin'. They don't have to overcome a culture where Coke and Pepsi are, you know, the national approach to hydration and where there isn't massive marketing of junk as a food group. These are huge problems. And it's even worse than that, because our food supply is actually literally engineered to be addictive. These junk foods aren't just, you know, junky and tasty. They're actually designed by scientists using functional MRI machines to figure out what formulas best put the human appetite center into overdrive. And you don't have to take my word for that. You can read the work of Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Michael Moss. He wrote Salt, Sugar, Fat. He also wrote a New York Times Magazine cover story entitled The Extraordinary Science of Addictive Junk Food. And it tells the gory details of all that. So that's not fair. And a lot of this really should be addressed through policy. A lot of it should be addressed through culture. But as John Mayer said, you know, we can't just keep waiting on the world to change. So what you need to do now is empower yourself with knowledge. What is an optimal diet? And, you know, how can I combine the joy of good eating with the joy of good health? I really want my family to have both of those. How can I leverage this immediately to reduce the risk I'm worried about today, COVID, but also use it to, you know, add years and vitality to my life? Because, you know, when all is said and done, healthy people have more fun. I want that. And how can I get there from here? You know, where can I source recipes and where can I get reliable information? And, you know, if I can throw a few suggestions out, first of all, if you want to know about your diet, you can visit the website of my company, Diet ID. We can help you learn a lot about your diet and how it lines up against what it ought to be for optimal health. If you're interested in the Katz family greatest hits, all of our recipes are available on my wife's recipe site, Cuisinicity.com. It's like Cuisine City with an I in the middle. All that's freely available. Help yourselves. So I could keep going, but, you know, basically you have to first decide you want to do something about it. And then, Steve, when enough of us decide that, when enough families and households decide we really care about this, we start to add up and become a cultural revolution. I think we need a cultural revolution, but we can start the cultural revolution one informed, outraged, empowered household at a time.
That's great. We've been enjoying your book, How to Eat. that you co-wrote with Mark Bittman. And in the book, you describe how grocery stores have changed on the inside of the aisles. Like, you've got the usual things in the fruits and the vegetables and the meats and those kinds of things, but there's just been this explosion of processed foods, which you describe in your book as being the same basic ingredients just mixed in different ways and presented to people for their convenience. That is a startling look at the grocery stores.
And that's the reality. So you go back half a century now, 1970s, and there were 15,000 different items in a typical supermarket in the United States. They're now well over 50,000. And, you know, how many new fruits and vegetables have we invented? Very few. So it's all packaged stuff. And it's all packaged stuff made from reshuffling a very short list of ingredients, plus a whole lot of junk. So, you know, the common ingredients are wheat and soy and sugar and corn. And those get recycled in, you know, umpteen different ways. And then, you know, what makes the products look and feel and taste a bit different is a chemistry experiment. So, you know, it's artificial flavorants and artificial colorants. And so, you know, it's same basic ingredients that will make packaged desserts and packaged breakfast cereals and packaged chips, and on it goes. This is terrible for human health because, you know, it denies our bodies the vital access to a wide array of naturally occurring nutrients in a diversity of foods. It's also terrible for land and the planet because, you know, when you're making pseudo food out of the same recycled four ingredients over and over again, you don't grow a wide variety of things. You grow those four things on vast acreage of monoculture. And that depletes the soil and requires that you use artificial chemical fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides. And so, you know, the total devastation here goes way beyond the immediate effects on our health of eating stuff that isn't really food and extends to ultimately a ruinous effect on soil, which is the foundation of our ability to produce food in the first place. Once we're done ruining the world's soil, we're cooked, frankly. And so, you know, everybody needs to care about this. So sustainability, you know, should not be a question. There should be no such thing as a conversation about a healthy dietary pattern at the population level that doesn't include sustainability, because otherwise, basically what it means is we're willing to eat up our children's food and leave them with nothing. And I shudder to think there's any parent willing to do that.
There is a lot of information about diet and nutrition, but it seems like there can be a big gap between what we know and actually making changes in our everyday behaviors. Where is a good place for someone to start who, you know, might be listening and realize, oh yeah, I do eat a lot of processed foods, or my diet does have a lot of meat and dairy in it, and I would like to start shifting, you know, to more health and vitality and also helping the planet. How do we start?
Well, at the risk of being self-serving, I know a good book. So, you know, How to Eat isn't a bad place to start. First of all, you know, it's really reliable, sensible, science-based. It's good stuff. So, you know, if you want to get grounded and oriented, what's really true about healthy, sustainable eating. I think Mark and I did a really nice job. But the other thing we did, you know, Mark's a fantastic writer, and we tried to make the book really fun and engaging. And I think that's important. You know, if this is not your space, not your wheelhouse, as it were, you know, you don't want to read something encyclopedic. You don't want to work all that hard, but you'd love to get informed and empowered. And this book is unusual. It reads like a conversation. So, you know, essentially, we're kicking questions back and forth and answering them. And it kind of feels like we're inviting you to, you know, pull up a chair to the coffee table. Mark and I are having coffee. We're kicking it around and you can join us. So, you know, again, at the risk of being self-serving, check out How to Eat. I'd invite you to go to your local bookstore if we weren't in the midst of COVID, but you can get it on Amazon and wherever you shop online. And then after that, there are all kinds of resources available. You know, there are apps to help you if your focus is weight. At Diet ID, we can help you assess your diet and compare it to a diet that's optimal for whatever your health objectives are. You know, these days, I think a lot of people are focused on diet and immune function. But, you know, maybe your goal is weight loss or preventing heart disease or diabetes or whatever it may be. And then, of course, there are lots of recipes available online. There are more and more services available to help people get to optimal nutrition in a variety of ways. So I think once you start, you know, you make the commitment that you'd like to know what's what, and you'd like to put it to use for your health and the health of your family, then, you know, essentially you're on your way, because, you know, each resource you access, a book, a website, an app, opens a doorway to the next set of resources. So, okay, now I know a lot about eating well, and I know what's true and what's reliable. Now I need recipes. Well, you know, then you start looking around for recipes, and that it's the same set of things: websites, apps, books. There's no shortage of resources. And although it may sound like there's a bit of work involved here, it's really not that hard. You know, it doesn't take all that long to develop a repertoire of healthy, delicious recipes. It doesn't take all that long to learn how to shop better. It's a small investment and a huge return. And I like to remind people that a lot of the things we rely on throughout our lives that are really valuable to us took some work in the beginning. Everybody can ride a bike, skinned their knees when they were first learning. You know, we all put up with that, learned how to ride, and then enjoy it for the rest of our lives. Everybody who can read and write had to struggle to learn the alphabet way back in kindergarten and first grade. It wasn't easy. We had to invest the effort, but a lifetime of benefit. I would argue that health deserves to be on that list. Eating well deserves to be on that list. Put in a little time, do a little learning, and derive a lifetime of benefit as a result.
How did you get into this work from the medical side of things?
I had a longstanding interest in nutrition and fitness beginning in my teenage years, you know, mostly directed inward. I was interested in my own athletic performance and fueling it well. My dad was a cardiologist, so I was a little more aware of these issues than the average person. But in terms of my medical career, it was simply the fact that when I trained in internal medicine, when you're doing your residency, you're in the hospital 100 plus hours a week, taking care of people sick enough to be in the hospital. And those are really sick people for the most part. And I noticed something that I think a lot of my colleagues may have overlooked, and that was we were all the king's horses and all the king's men. In other words, no matter what we did to, you know, try to keep people from dying and try to patch them back up, we were never going to make them as healthy and vital as they would have been if they'd never gotten so sick in the first place. And I thought, yeah, I don't want to spend my whole career being all the king's horses, all the king's men. I'd really rather prevent the fall from the wall in the first place. And so how can I help do that? So I went on to train in preventive medicine. And the issue there was that the most important opportunity to prevent disease, the most important opportunity to promote health, to make people's lives better, was in the lifestyle medicine space. It was diet and physical activity and helping people quit smoking. So I said, well, that, you know, I'm interested in clinical care and teaching and research, and I'd sort of be interested in doing research that can answer all kinds of unexplored questions. But it really seems to me like the greatest potential difference I can make in my career is not to focus on a bunch of stuff we don't know, but to figure out how to make better use of what we do know. We already know how to add years to lives and life to years. We're just not doing it. We already know how to use lifestyle to prevent literally 80% of all major chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, dementia. I mean, what a better world it would be if 8 times in 10 the people we love did not have a stroke or a heart attack or get diagnosed with cancer. That's absolutely possible based on knowledge we already have. So I decided I had to devote my career to turning that knowledge into the power of routine action. And it's 30 years later and I'm still at it.
It's interesting to think about how medical doctors haven't talked about nutrition and these lifestyle choices for a long, long time. And now they're starting to. From my perspective as a medical consumer, as it were, if I go to my doctor, I'd say it's been only in the last couple of years that he's been asking me about food and diet and drinking and those kinds of things. And it seems like now you used to have to go outside the Western medicine. You know, you'd have to go to a chiropractor or a nutritionist or Eastern medicine and those kinds of places where, you know, it's not cut it out or give it a pill to fix it. And so now there's been a proliferation of information, and you're on the cutting edge of that in a way, but there's also misinformation out there. There's a lot of fad diets. You talk about those in your book, How to Eat. And then there's things like the medical medium, where he says that everything is Epstein-Barr, and if you eat wild blueberries, you're going to be fine. Do you have a perspective on people like Dr. Greger, who wrote a book called How Not to Die, and or the medical medium? Where should people be looking for really good information?
So yes, you know, all of that is good commentary. There is a shift to more focus on diet, nutrition, and mainstream medicine. We've got a long way to go, but there's progress. So I'd like to encourage people to check out a website, truehealthinitiative.org, because Steve, I was wrestling with that very issue. You know, even if a diverse group of experts mostly agree, when you hand us a microphone and say, you know, I'm putting you on the air, I want you to say something special, we tend to talk about the area of disagreement. What makes me special is, you know, what I think, what I know, what I recommend that's different from everybody else. So let me tell you about that and why paleo's best or Mediterranean's best or vegan is best or, you know, whatever it is. But the reality behind the scenes may be actually the paleo expert, the vegan expert, and the Mediterranean diet expert agree 90% of the time. They're just not talking about that. They're talking about the 10%. And that creates a false impression of massive disagreement where, in fact, there's massive agreement. I thought that was true, and I wanted to prove it. So I created this nonprofit, the True Health Initiative, and I invited all those different experts, experts in every kind of diet, experts in sustainability, experts in public health, preventive medicine, every other kind of medicine, experts in the culinary arts and agricultural practices, experts who ate paleo, experts who ate vegan, experts who ate Mediterranean and everything else you can think of. And I said, you guys are genuinely experts. Would you agree that everybody would be better off if we ate real food, mostly plants? That, you know, the best diets are always made up predominantly of vegetables, fruits, beans, lentils, often whole grains, nuts and seeds, that plain water is best to drink. That if you combine that with routine physical activity and avoid toxins, it can make a huge difference and help you reduce your risk of all chronic disease by 80%. Would you agree with your colleagues about that? Would you agree the public deserves to know that? Anyway, the answer was overwhelmingly, hell yeah. And so we have roughly 500 world-leading experts, and by world-leading experts, I mean several past surgeons general of the United States, CEOs of major healthcare organizations, deans of schools, chairs of departments, household names like Sanjay Gupta from Health Journalism, celebrity chefs, all coming together to say, we agree. We agree about these fundamentals. Dr. Greger is there, by the way. The medical medium is not. So, you know, some people stake out their own contrarian position, and it's not really rooted in science. Other people like Dr. Greger are very committed to science. You know, he's very ardent in his advocacy for a whole food plant exclusive diet, which I think is fine. You know, as long as what he says is true and he can back it up, and that's certainly the case for him. So he's a member of the True Health Initiative Council. It's a place to go to see, you know, here's a person whose advice I'm taking. Are they aligned with the science? Are they aligned with the sense? And are they part of the global consensus of experts? So check out truehealthinitiative.org, read the principles there. And it's part of the reality check, Steve, that people need to do. I mean, obviously with the internet, everybody can broadcast their opinion to the world. Some of those opinions are genuinely expert, and some of them are imposters. You've got to be good at telling the difference, and this is one resource you can use to help make that distinction.
We're going to list those resources on our website, and we'll be posting this interview on our podcast as well. Dr. David Katz is a lifestyle medicine specialist and author, among many other things. Of course, I'd love to talk to you all day. I know you have to go save the world, but before I let you go, Can you tell us what you had for breakfast and what is it about butter that got you together with your co-author?
Well, my breakfast, I'm looking at it right now. I'm having a late breakfast today. It's a bowl of blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, banana, raisin, and whole grain cereal mixed together. So that's today's breakfast, and it's fairly typical. And by the way, it's an expensive breakfast. Berries are expensive, but they're also, you know, they're super nutritious. I love them, so it's an indulgence. And then the butter issue. So Mark is a, you know, he writes about agricultural policy and sourcing food. He's a brilliant cook. He wrote How to Cook Everything, which is an iconic bestseller. But he's also weighed in over the years on studies about diet and health. And every now and then he's gotten something wrong because he's not trained in science and epidemiology. So Mark and I became friends and partners and co-authors because I kind of picked a fight with him a couple times. Once or twice I thought he had gotten something wrong, and it was more in my wheelhouse than his. So I wrote to him, and I thought, you know, I'd never hear back, or if I did hear back, he'd say, mind your own business. But he didn't do that. He did just what you hope people will do in a civil world. He said, tell me more and why it's wrong and how you know. And he actually listened. And, you know, this is the way the world used to be before everything was so polarized. People could agree to disagree, could learn from one another. And that's just what happened. He listened to me. I listened to him. You know, when he was wrong, he said, mea culpa, I'll fix it and set the record straight. And then the next time he was writing on that topic, he actually turned to me with questions ahead of time. When I had questions about agriculture and so forth, I turned to him. And a beautiful friendship was born, and all of our partnership in literary effort as a result. But it's just also a really nice example. This relationship began with a civil disagreement among people who were willing to listen to one another. It was so refreshing because that, you know, it seems to be something from a quaint old time. We hardly ever do that anymore, but Mark and I did it, and good things came of it. So, you know, maybe that's the lesson there, Steve. It's actually good to listen and talk to people whose opinion may differ from your own.
Dr. Katz, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Is there anything else you'd like to share with listeners?
Well, I just want to thank you both for having me and tell everybody, you know, keep calm, carry on, and stay safe through all this craziness.
I'm going to play you a song on the way out here, Dr. Katz. It's about America's favorite food. Would you care to take a wild guess at, I'll give you that it is a vegetable. I believe it's a vegetable.
I would have guessed donuts, so I'll be curious to hear what it is.
It's corn, of course.
Okay.
All right, have a good one, doctor.
Thank you. Care, guys.
You too. Bye-bye.
When I was just a nitty-bitty lad, loaded up the car with mom and dad, headed out east for a couple of weeks. There in Nebraska, I became aware, afternoon heat and the sun's evil glare of a crop. Rifle picking. It grows and grows and grows and grows. Looking out the window, I began to doze. If it didn't say what it was, you'd call me rude. Comes in white and it comes in yeller. Fully mature, it's taller than the feller. Staple of the nation, oyster of the great Midwest. I'm talking about corn. Corn. In flakes, it greets me early in the morn. I'm talking about corn. Yes. Yes, America, America's favorite food. Walking on up. First, it seemed too good to be true. Food that grows red, white, and blue when you eat it. Fully digested. Yes, America. America's favorite food. Walking on America. Yes, America.